Simmons has started the Grandland Network.
Grandland Network.
Basically, he's rounded up some people capable of talking about sports and other stuff too, in an entertaining way, if I were to take a guess.
This is the Grandland Network.
Hi, welcome to the BS Report. Bill is in London, but I'm Jay Caspian Kang, filling in for Bill. I'm here today with Haralambos Bulgaris. He's a basketball bettor and a high-stakes poker player, and we're going to talk a little bit about Olympic basketball, a little bit about a crazy tournament that Haralambos played in recently, and just the sort of industry of basketball betting in general. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Jay?
Good. I want to start with the U.S. team. They've been having a little bit of well-publicized trouble in some of these games. I don't know if it's actually as full-blown as people say it is. I don't know if it's as if the team is as good as people say it is when they look good. And what is your general assessment of it? Is this team better or worse than people expected?
I don't know how good people expected the team to be. I mean, it's a really good basketball team, obviously. I think their main enemy or bit of competition in this tournament is just boredom. I mean, they're playing teams that aren't necessarily able to compete with them, I think, when the team plays as good as they can play. There's a couple teams that maybe would be able to contend with them, but in general, the team is just filled with too many good players. They're just far better than their competition.
And do you think it's like this thing where the last Olympics, the team looked so good because there was this mission of redeeming? They're called the Redeem Team. They're trying to avenge that third place finish before. Like, what? I struggled to think about what this team's motivation could even possibly be going into some of these games, especially since it seems like they can turn it off and on.
It looks like their main motivation is to have fun when they're playing. I mean, obviously they want to win and they expect to win, but they just look like, first of all, the team that played in 2004 wasn't the best American players. I mean, the players that were playing weren't the best players. So the idea that now in 2008, I think in 2008 they did have pretty much their best team that was available to them. And then now, with the exception of maybe like not having Dwight Howard, who's injured, it's pretty much the best collection of American players they could possibly come up with. So as far as what their motivation is, you know, redeeming themselves from something that happened in 2004 and trying to reclaim the fact that they're dominant, possibly, but I just think these guys are just there to have fun, win a gold medal. It's pretty cool. I mean, the fact that you got all these young guys hanging out, spending time together, and beating teams by 50-plus points a game, it's kind of interesting, I think.
But do you find that cool? I mean, I sometimes
it would be cool to be
boring.
Them. I'm just saying it would be cool to be them. I find it boring, too. I can't sit through an entire game. But if it was them, it would be awesome. I mean, they're in London having fun, taking the subway.
It would be great to be like a single multimillionaire basketball player in Olympic Village right now, I think.
I don't think they stay in the Olympic Village, though, do they?
I don't know. If you were them, wouldn't you stay in the Olympic Village? I mean, who cares, right? I'm sure that the accommodations are great and that there's just
no. The accommodations are terrible in the Olympic Village. I mean,
you been there?
I've seen video of it, and a friend of mine went to the Beijing Olympics. But I've saw the video of like I've seen like you know twit pics and seen video of some of the. No, I don't think that. I know in '92 they stayed in a hotel. In Barcelona, I haven't really followed since, but I can't imagine these players are staying in the. I mean, look, Kobe Bryant can't go anywhere without getting mobbed. I can't imagine he's hanging out in the Olympic Village, taking taking all the free condoms he can get.
I don't know. That, I mean, that's what I was gonna say.
Plus, like, he's got his family. A lot of them have
free
condoms. A lot of them have their families with them too. Like Chris Paul's got his family with him. Kobe's got his wife and kids with him. So I think I would wager a large amount of money that they're not staying at the Olympic Village, but I haven't researched it or even read about it or anything like that. I haven't really followed the Olympics that much this year. It's not that exciting.
What's made it not exciting for you?
Well, the Olympics in general isn't exciting because it's like it's a real challenge to actually be able to watch it. It's on tape delay, all this other stuff, and then just there isn't really another team. I mean, in the past, you know, you kind of had like Argentina could compete with the U.S., Spain was pretty good. You felt like there was a chance that, you know, a team could play some kind of offensive and defensive scheme to really... And maybe that'll still happen in the middle round. I'm not sure. Maybe this team will have a bad game and lose or have, like, a close game. And that possibly... I mean, it happened against Lithuania. And it happened for a half a basketball versus Argentina in a meaningless game. But I just feel like it's just not that, there isn't really like an enemy. It's just kind of, they're playing these random teams and generally overmatching them. I think Russia will be a good matchup to watch. I mean, the Russia game should, I mean, if they play Russia, will be exciting. But other than that, I don't think any team will really be able to beat them.
Well, before the Olympics, Spain was sort of cast as that potential enemy, right? But Spain hasn't played particularly well. But you can see, like, with the U.S., because they're undersized up front, they only have Tyson Chandler, who seems to get into foul trouble immediately.
Right.
Internationally. I mean, could you see Spain actually running some sort of, like what you're saying, running schemes and sort of planning around a way to beat the United States?
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, what, they play like a 40-minute game. So, I mean, any team could theoretically win in some ways. And Spain, possibly, because they do have, I mean, you need like a dominating big, and you have to like pick and roll the team to death, basically, which is what Lithuania did. They just ran pick and roll, high pick and roll all game. But I also think that given a little bit more time to prepare, I think in the medal round, they'll probably be able to scheme a little bit better on defense. They'll probably play some of their better defensive players a little bit more. Maybe Iguodala will play more than Kobe. Maybe they'll put LeBron on the ball handler. Although I guess LeBron's kind of forced to guard the bigs now because he's like their de facto power forward. Marc Gasol's not really healthy as well. So
sure, but I mean, Powell is playing really well, and you know, if Marc Gasol does suit up and play against the United States, then LeBron has to guard one of the Gasol brothers in that game. Like, I know that he's a great defensive player, but that seems like a too much size for him, even. And then with Spain's wings and some of their ability to shoot, I mean, I don't know. I think it could be a competitive game. Like before in the exhibition game, though, there was this sort of talk that Spain was withholding a lot of their plays, that they're just sort of seeing this as like they're going to go out and lose and see if they could be competitive for 10 minutes and then sort of give up. Like,
yeah,
do you give any credence to any of those?
No, I would. That would definitely be the smart strategy. I mean, you wouldn't want to start running all your sets in the meaningless games, or they're not meaningless, but the somewhat meaningless games. So, there's definitely a possibility for that. Spain probably wasn't in their best interest to play as good as they can in their last few games. Just for seeding purposes, so that's possible. But in terms of like a player being a tough matchup for LeBron, I mean, it goes both ways. Now, who's going to guard LeBron on the other end? And this team plays, the U.S. team plays so fast that if you're the other team, you really have to, whoever's playing them has to really do a good job of controlling the pace and tempo of the game. And they don't really play single matchup defense. They're kind of swarming and they double team and they try to play a little bit of zone, but they don't play that much of it. But they just kind of aggressively overplay the passing lanes and create turnovers and try to create pace and tempo. And so I don't think that one of the Gasol brothers being guarded by LeBron James is that tough a matchup for LeBron James, to be honest with you. I mean, I think it's. I mean, sure, if they were dominant post players, but neither one of them really has like a spectacular back-to-the-basket post game. I mean,
you don't think Powell does? I mean, Powell is leading the Olympics in scoring right now. He's playing pretty well.
He does, but it's like you don't get. It's not like having someone like Dwight Howard, where you're like worried of the guy just like punishing you, or like a Tim Duncan. I mean, I guess Powell does a little bit, but he does a lot of his stuff facing the basket, and he does a lot of his stuff off of different types of action. I don't think if they play that LeBron will be forced to guard Powell. I think they would probably put him on Mark if they had to, just because Mark's like less of an offensive player, and it's probably what I would do. I don't know, but yeah, I mean, Pau Gasol's a great player. I just don't see. I don't. I guess Spain. I think Russia is a team that might be able to kind of give them a little bit of run, because I think they kind of expect the U.S. kind of expects Spain to be a little bit tougher. This Russian team's fun. They run a lot of. They have decent guards. They run a pretty exciting offense, I think. They're constantly in motion. Kirilenko's always coming off the ball. I think that's a team that might be able to catch them by surprise a little bit.
Just because of the ball movement?
A little bit of the ball movement, and also a little bit, they just match up. I mean, they don't match up. They don't have, like, the offensive power that Spain does that the U.S. has to worry about. But the other side of it is that, you know, Spain has to guard the U.S. team, and I think Russia just has, like, more of like a lanky type of athletic style of player that can actually match up a little bit better with the shooting of the U.S. team than Spain does.
Okay, well, I mean, one of those lanky guys I think you're talking about is that one of the people that basketball nerds have been talking about a lot in these Olympics, which is Alexei Shved, who's going to Minnesota next year to play presumably alongside Rubio. Like, I don't know.
I don't think he'll play alongside him. I think he's kind of like a... I don't know. I don't really buy the fact that he's a two guard. I buy him more as like a point guard or a scorer.
Yeah, I do too. But I mean, I think that they're bringing him over really to like see if they can play together. I mean, I guess I've watched a lot of Shved's possessions. I think I've watched all of his possessions actually. And you know, I see all the skill. I mean, he's a great shooter. You know, he gets sort of into the lane like Klay Thompson gets into the lane, where he has this sort of herky jerky.
Right. He can't go left.
Where he crosses over. Yeah, he can't go left, but he can get to the rack. And he's like a wild passer. Like, he tries to make all these jump passes, stuff like that, turns the ball over a lot. But, you know, he is, by, you know, for all intents and purposes, their point guard. I don't know, what have your impressions of him been? Like, can he play pretty well at the NBA level, do you think?
Yeah, I think he definitely has the potential to be a decent player. I don't see him as a two guard at all. I mean, I see him as just a point guard or a change of pace type of point guard. So I don't really see him and Rubio playing too much together. But yeah, I think he can play in the NBA. He's probably, of all the players I've seen, that aren't currently in the NBA, he's probably the one player that I've been the most interested in watching, him. And then I like watching Kirilenko again. Kirilenko seems like he's kind of rejuvenated a little bit. But yeah, I think he can play in the NBA. I think he'll be all right. It's tough to say because first of all, the game itself is not the same as NBA basketball. The rules are different. Just the game, it just looks different. So it's always tough to say how the international players will translate, especially guards in some ways.
Yeah.
But just because there's the way you can play defense in international play versus the way you can play defense in the NBA is completely different. Like you can't, you know, the no hand check rule in the NBA makes it so much tougher if you're an unathletic point guard. But I mean, if Jose Calderon can play in the NBA and carve out like a decent career, I'm sure Shved can.
And make $11 million a year.
Yeah, I'm sure Shved can. Yeah.
Shved, the one thing that makes me think that he's going to be all right is that even with the hand checking rules in international play, and you know, like he can get in the lane. He gets in the lane pretty easily, actually. And you pair that with like a jump shot that, you know, is pretty streaky, but pretty effective. Like, I just don't see how that doesn't turn into like a decent NBA player.
Yeah, I'm more worried about the other side of it where he has to actually guard like a Russell Westbrook.
Yeah, and can you imagine him and Rubio playing defense at the same time?
Yeah, that's why I don't see them.
Like, it would be terrible.
Rubio's actually a pretty good defender. He's for a rookie, his numbers were quite good last year.
Okay, well, that's actually something I wanted you to explain, because I don't think we've actually introduced you really properly except for the sort of hardcore basketball guys who know who you are already, but you've probably watched more NBA basketball than anyone on this planet really for the past like 10 years, right?
Yeah, it's hard to watch more. You could watch about as much, but it'd be hard to watch more. There's like a year I watched like almost every game at some point.
And the purpose of this is because you are betting on basketball, right?
Yeah, of course, betting on basketball.
All right, so then, and through this, like, you build up a database. Can you just explain some of that to us, just the process of like how you...
Sure. Well, when I first started betting on basketball, there wasn't the idea of... I mean, data wasn't really prevalent. My method of handicapping was... I mean, you had box score data, but that's it. I don't think play-by-play data became available until like the 2003 season.
Like, what year was this roughly?
Like 2000, when I first started betting at like a... where I was actually betting significant money was probably around 2000, 2001. So there wasn't as much data. So my method back then was I did a lot of subjective stuff. I watched a lot of basketball. I taped a lot of basketball. I watched replays. I was pretty much always watching basketball or reading about basketball during the basketball season. So there wasn't really a building of a database or anything like that until like 05 or 06, because it wasn't really necessary for me and the data wasn't readily available. That's kind of how I got my start. So I watch a lot of basketball, but not nearly, I'm not nearly as reliant on actually watching the games as I was back in the day.
What sort of things does your database take into account that like people can't find on your typical sort of advanced stats site?
Well, I think like the misnomer is that like I do database work. Like people talk about databases. I mean, you can have a database and that's great, and all a database is just a bunch of data organized in tables. But it's kind of how you deal with that and what you do with it. We actually create models around the data. So we simulate basketball possession by possession. So our database is, we have all the data that anyone could get if they paid Stats Inc. for it or scraped ESPN or did all the other stuff. Just all the play-by-play data that's out there. And then in addition to that, we chart some proprietary stuff and we do some different stuff within the data to record different elements. So
who do you mean by we? Like
me and the guys who work for me or with me, I suppose. I mean, okay. When I first started, it was me. And then since then, I've hired some people, and some of them have become like on a partner level almost. Some of the guys have worked for me. So that's we.
Okay, cool.
Or like the royal we, me, basically. Basically, I'm the one pulling the trigger on all these decisions and deciding everything. So it's my operation for the most part. But there's a lot of people behind the scenes that are doing a lot of the work.
And a lot of these, like, are these sort of models based a lot on sort of specific matchups?
A little bit. I mean, it's not really necessarily how this specific player's numbers will differ versus that player so much as it's just, I mean, when you get to the point of playoffs, matchups are important, but during the regular season, you don't want to get too involved in like matchups. It's just more of a possession by possession simulation of what goes on the court and how we think, you know, what we think the true value of specific players are versus what the perceived value is via the people who are making the lines or the other basketball experts, I suppose, the other people you're betting against.
Okay, we'll get back to that in a bit, but I just want to finish up a couple thoughts about USA Basketball, and then we'll get to gambling, okay. Which is, I think, what we probably both want to talk
about.
Yeah,
gambling stuff seems a lot more interesting to me in general.
Me too, shockingly enough. All right, well, one thing you talked about was the pace of the games, and that this team gets out and runs and plays in the full court. I guess one of the things is, for me, watching the team, is that I think that Chris Paul has played really well, and I can acknowledge that he sort of saved them against Lithuania, but wondering if he's actually really the right point guard for the team. He plays so much in the half court, just watching him all year in the Clippers, on press row, just that he doesn't really have the ability to push the action forward. He's more comfortable in the half court. He's more comfortable in isolation. I think he was like the second. He had the second highest isolation rate in the league this year. Do you think the team would be better off maybe with a point guard like Rondo or somebody who can run the ball up
no,
the court a little bit better?
No, I don't think you'd ever be in a better position to have someone like Rondo versus Chris Paul. I mean, Chris Paul's just a better player than Rondo. I'm a big Chris Paul fan. I think a lot of the reason why, I mean, people push the ball because they can't get things in the half court. He pushes the ball. It's just he's not one of those point guards who he's not really plotting. I don't necessarily agree with. I mean, the reason why he has a lot of isolation plays is because he runs a lot of pick and roll and teams switch on him, so then he ends up being ISO'd against the big guy. But yeah, a little bit. I mean, he definitely does dribble a little bit too much and will find himself, when teams aggressively double and trap him, he does find himself fighting the shot clock a little bit. But, you know, I'd like to see Derrick Rose on the team, but he's hurt. I think that was the point guard they really wanted was Derrick Rose. But Chris Paul is probably as good as Derrick Rose, if not maybe a little bit better. I mean, I don't know. I used to think Chris Paul was way better than Derrick Rose, and then Derrick Rose kind of blew me away the last 2 years. So I'm kind of rethinking that. But,
yeah, I mean, I you know, you live in Los Angeles as well. That's where I lived the last year, and I'll be returning soon, you know, despite this short trip to New York. Like, watching Chris Paul in person is really something else. You start to respect him a lot more just through the way that he gets to the rim. The way that he dribbles, some of the moves that he has are just ridiculous.
Right.
And I think that that's something that's an element of his game that is a little bit difficult, that doesn't really translate so much to television, because you see him get by his guy, but then when you're up a little bit closer, you just see the ridiculous move that he put on the guy and how far the guy jumped the other way, and it's hard not to watch him and just be like, this is the best point guard in the NBA.
Yeah, the thing about Chris Paul is if you have like no talent on your team, but you have Chris Paul, your team will probably be competitive. Whereas he might not be, like what you said, he might not be the guy you want with all these other great players, because part of his game is just figuring out. I mean, against Memphis in the playoffs last year, I went to the overtime game. I went to two of the games, but in the overtime game especially, he scored like, he basically had a hand or created or scored all of their points in the overtime in the fourth quarter. It was just a joke. And he had like the entire team keyed on him, the entire other defensive team keyed on him. So now, do you need that type of point guard when you've got Kevin Durant and LeBron and all these other great scorers? Maybe not, but I don't know. I think he's a fine fit for the team. I don't think that anyone has said, oh, the reason why this team isn't going to win is because of their point guard play.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I was just thinking from purely that like theoretical standpoint. No, I mean, he's obviously been probably good.
You need an unselfish point guard to be playing on this team, so he's probably the right guy. I mean, Rondo's like that as well, but I just think Rondo, Rondo might be all right, because Rondo would like never shoot. You know, he's like an all-time assist whore, so he'd be good for this team because he'd be like racking up the assists left, right, and center, you know, passing up wide open layups so he could kick it out to Durant from like 30 feet from the three-point line. That's like his style.
Yeah.
So he might be more interesting in some ways, but I don't know. I think if it does become a close game and it becomes like a possession-by-possession game, there isn't a point guard I'd rather have than Chris Paul on my team.
All right, cool. All right, well, actually, let's just switch over to the gambling portion of the podcast. We talked about it a little bit before, but you and I met in Las Vegas about, I don't know, maybe five weeks ago.
About 5 weeks ago.
And you told me a story about how you got started in gambling that just blew my mind, that made me think that all my years of what I thought was pulling up stakes and, you know, making big bets was ridiculous. Can you just take me through that? Just what happened when you made a bet on the Lakers?
Oh, yeah. So this is like...
Just tell us a little bit about your background, like where you grew up.
Just to make it really quick, I was living in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, in my brother's basement, attending the University of Manitoba, studying philosophy and working as a skycap at the airport. And I was betting on basketball at the time, but I was betting smaller amounts. I was betting like, you know, $500, $600, maybe $1,000, which is a lot of money. But back then, you know, compared to where I am now, it seems like it was ridiculous. When I first started, I was betting a lot smaller. But at some point in and around the 99 season, I had, or before the 99 season, I had saved up some money. And I don't know. I just was kind of like looking. I remember one day I was working a 4 a.m. shift at the airport as a skycap. I owned the skycap company, so it wasn't like I made a little bit of money doing that while I was going to university. But I remember just sitting there outside in like the dead of winter and looking around and watching all these, they call them snowbirds, but it's the older people who go to live in Florida for the winter,
sure.
Canadians. And I was just like, I'm not going to wait till I'm 70 years old before I'm able to fly away from this like barren place. I mean, Winnipeg's a great city, but it's miserable in the wintertime. So I was like, I got to get the out of here. I mean, this is not where I want to be for the rest of my life. So I don't know, for whatever, I think that was like the impetus that winter. And then I was betting and I was being pretty successful. But then I started like thinking about how much money, you know, how long it would take me to get to the point where I could make a lot of money betting on basketball, starting with like my bankroll, which was at the time, I think that winter it was like 45,000 or something. And I was like, it's gonna take me a long time. If you use like the Kelly criterion where you bet like 5% of your bankroll on each individual play, I mean, it takes a long time before you can get to the point where you're making, you know, a lot of money. So the next year, the Lakers hired Phil Jackson as their coach. I thought the Lakers were probably on paper the most talented team the year before, but they just had no concept of
what year was this again?
This was like this is pre-99 season, the year they won it in 2000. So this is the 99 season, the year the strike shortened season that the Spurs won, and the next year the Lakers won.
Sure.
So the year before, so the 2000 season, what they call the 99-2000 season, the Lakers hired Phil Jackson as their coach. And back then I was like a Phil Jackson, like I thought Phil Jackson was like the greatest basketball coach of all time. And now I think he's a good coach, but I'm not nearly as you know, big believer in.
Hey, can you explain that? Because that is the sort of like, you know, that's what makes interest me in you as a basketball mind, because you.
What's that? The
make
Phil
these
Jackson
sort of
thing?
Pronouncements, and you're like the one guy who makes these sort of.
Well, here's the thing about Phil Jackson. It's like,
and then like puts your money behind it.
Well, so, here's the thing about Phil Jackson is like, I was this Phil Jackson super fan. I thought he was, I mean, he's definitely the best at managing players and all this other stuff, and getting the team to buy into a single goal or whatever. But in terms of basketball analytics, and he's, I mean, he doesn't. So I talked to someone who worked with the Lakers, and we were, you know, this is like in 04 or 03 or something. And we were talking about like corner 3-point shots. And I read something where Phil Jackson said he hates having his team take corner 3-point shots because they're just bad and they lead to fast breaks the other way. And I remember reading about this and thinking, is he like saying this because it's misinformation, or does he really believe the corner 3-point shot's a terrible shot to take on offense? Because that's the best shot you can take in basketball aside from a layup, is a corner 3-point shot.
Sure.
It has like a 1.25, roughly 1.25 points per, I don't know the exact number, but it's high. I think it's 1.25, but I could be wrong. I'm just kind of plucking that out of what.
Points per possession.
Yeah, per attempt. So every time
this is like a more broad podcast. Can you just explain like the difference between points per possession and, you know?
So every time you take a shot from the corner, you just expect to make 1.25 points.
Yeah.
So whereas if you're taking like a 18 or 19 foot jump shot, that shot is worth 0.7 points. So every time you take the shot, it's worth roughly 0.7 points. Obviously, it's either going to be worth 2 or 0, but when you average it out over a bunch of possessions, it's going to be worth 0.7 if you're taking the contested or the long 2-point shot. So aside from a layup or like a dunk or whatever, a close-in shot, the number one shot you want to take in basketball is a corner 3-point shot. So sure, Phil Jackson is telling his team he doesn't want them taking these corner 3-point shots. And what's more is he doesn't really care about defending them, because he thinks that when they miss, that you're just going to get a layup the other way. So I went and charted in 05, I went and charted every single corner, every single 3-point shot, and recorded how many, like watch the video. We have this tool that we could use, kind of similar to what Synergy is. Mm-hmm. And watched them and just charted to see if he was right or wrong. And he was wrong. They didn't really lead to more layups. In fact, I think they led to less layups than your average 3-point shot. But what really resonated with me is the year they played Boston and lost. Was I went to the game where Boston came back from that ridiculous deficit in the second half, and I remember telling my girlfriend at the time when the Lakers were up like 15 or whatever it was that they were going to lose, and she was like, "No, they're not," and I was like, "No, look at how ridiculous they're playing." And basically, the entire Boston offense is predicated upon like Eddie House and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce shooting these corner 3-point shots, and you'd have Lamar Odom streaking down the court the other way when the shot was up in the air, waiting for the rebound to come that never came because they were always pulling the ball out of the basket, and that just happened over and over and over again. So then that just made me think, I mean, this guy's the greatest coach of all time, but he doesn't know that you shouldn't have your opponent shoot corner 3-point shots. I mean, it seems weird. I think someone got a hold of him in like the 11 season or the 10th, and they changed their offense where they decide to force everything to the strong side and a little bit when they started defending the 3-point shot a little bit better. But that year they lost to Boston, they were one of the worst teams at defending the corner of all the teams in the league that year.
Maybe he was traumatized by that year where he had to watch Gary Payton brick like 50
corner 3.
Corner 3.
Yeah, possibly. Or like, it's weird though. It's such a to me it was just so foreign, because I just assumed that if you're a basketball coach, you would want to know about the numbers, and maybe that's secondary to some of these guys, and they're able, the fact that he's able to still be like the most successful coach in the history of the NBA. And didn't really spend much time using analytics is pretty impressive, obviously. But he also had the best talent. But I just feel like that year they lost to Boston, that was such a basic component of Boston's offense. And it was like, I don't know, it would be like someone saying, "I don't like playing pocket aces because I get unlucky when I have them in poker." That's what it seemed to me. Like, I don't want to take this 1.25 points per possession shot. I just want to, you know, I want to work around and take the one from the top of the key, which is like worth like 1.05 points. Because I'm worried about floor spacing and the other team streaking back and getting dunks and layups the other way.
Sure. All right. Well, so what we were talking about before that aside was
I was a big Phil Jackson super fan in 99. I thought he was awesome. I thought he was gonna take the Lakers and turn them into a championship team. I thought they had on talent. They picked up like Ron Harper. They made like a couple other. My memory is pretty bad, but I think they picked up Horace Grant around that time as well.
They picked up Ron Harper.
Ron Harper is a pretty good point guard to have at that time. He's a good.
He was.
No, I mean it was what they needed. They needed a veteran. Like if you watched them play, that was the year. You know, the year before was the year Kobe was like airballing every shot versus the Utah Jazz.
Yeah.
And they were just getting killed by the Spurs. So whatever they. I thought they were going to be, and I said to myself, "Wow, this! I wonder what the price is going to be on them next year when they start. You know, when the season starts to win the championship." And I also had in my mind like the vision of all these snowbirds, like 80-year-old snowbirds, like just looking forward to flying to Florida for the winter. I think I made the bet, started making the bet like within the first week of the season. The season had already started. I think Kobe was injured at the time; he missed like the first X amount of games that year. And I just started betting the Lakers to win the championship from like the fifth or sixth game of the year to maybe like the 10th game of the year. I just kept on accumulating the bets and betting at different, and you know, wiring money and depositing money via Western Union to these places all over the world. And so I ended up betting almost my entire net worth at the time on the Lakers at an average price of like 6.5 to 1.
So, like, what was your total?
I don't remember the exact amount because it's weird over time, like, how your memory is kind of, but it was because the thing that makes it weird for me is it was U.S. dollars. So I was thinking how much it was worth in Canadian dollars, but I was betting U.S. dollars, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So, and the exchange rate was either 1.5, I can't remember exactly if it was 1.5 or 1, but it was, like, around like, $85,000 U.S., I think. Around 70 to 80, whatever the amount was U.S. On them to win the NBA championship.
And how much money did you have in the world at that point when you were
probably that plus like $4,000 or $3,000? But I had like no.
That's what struck me when I was talking to you is that you told me that you bet about like I think the number you told me was like 75 and 80, and you said that like. You had about $80,000 and you bet $75,000.
Yeah, I think that's probably about it. It might have been like 70. I don't remember exactly because I got stiffed on some of it. So,
and like, it was all on one bet with no hedging, right?
No, I didn't have any more money to hedge for the most part. And nobody, I remember calling up one sports book and being like, I got all this money on the Lakers to win the championship. But I couldn't really hedge because the time when I could hedge was I wanted to bet Portland to win the series when Portland was down 3-1.
Let's set that up a little bit. So like,
people might not remember
what happened that season.
Well, I had almost all my money, yes. But so what happened that season was they basically steamrolled during the regular season. They were a dominant team. They played really, really good. They ended up getting the number one seed. Portland was actually a really good team that year too. They were coached by Mike Dunleavy, and they were actually quite good. And they actually probably had the better team looking back, like 1 through 12.
Yeah, I mean that was a team where nobody scored over 14 or 15 points a game, but everybody on the team was good.
Yeah, they were stacked. Yeah. And they played like a completely unique style of basketball in quarters 1 through 3 and then a completely different style in the fourth quarter, which was probably because of Mike Dunleavy as coaching style. But they were like the best 1 through 3 quarter basketball team, but they just tightened up a little bit in the fourth quarter because they didn't have that one dominant scorer. The season went down. The Lakers kind of, I felt pretty, I forgot about the bet. I just went about my life. It's not like I needed that money to do anything.
You didn't need the $75,000 of your $80,000 net worth.
No, because I was going to, the way I looked at it was I was working as a SkyCap while I was going to university. I was living in my brother's basement. I was, if I won the bet, my life was going to change dramatically. If I lost the bet, my life wasn't going to... I wasn't doing anything with that money. It's not like you can do anything with $70,000. What are you going to do with... So it's basically 1 year or a year and a half's worth of salary for someone who's a professional or a working professional. I was making pretty good money with my SkyCap company. So it was basically... If I lost the bet or didn't make the bet, my life wasn't going to change at all. I mean, maybe I'd be able to take like a vacation and go somewhere with my girlfriend at the time and maybe do something and whatever, but it wasn't going to make my life any different. You can't really do a lot with $70,000 unless you're going to invest it. So to me, it just seemed like it was just a good way to fast forward my life 6 or 7 years. And then I thought I could make a lot of I could do a lot of damage with like $500,000 bankroll and actually betting. I thought like I could actually do a lot more. And if I lost, I was just going to go back to work, and it would take me about half a year or a year to make about that much money working as a sky cap while I went to university. So I put aside tuition and books, whatever it costs for books and tuition, and basically rolled the rest.
And then so that season for the Lakers got down to game 7 against that Portland team.
Well,
right?
First they were up 3-1.
Yeah.
In the Western Conference Finals, and that was a de facto finals of the playoffs because no team in the East was going to beat either Portland or the Lakers.
Sure.
So when they were up 3-1, I was like, maybe I should hedge. This seems like, you know, not a bad situation.
Yeah.
But then I didn't really, you know, I had to do all the stuff, and I had to wire them. And then I thought, why would I want to waste this money? And that's always been, since that point, I've never really been like a hedger. I mean, to me, it was either it's a good bet or it's not a good bet. So you're not really hedging. If I thought, and I didn't think Portland was going to win the series, so I thought, why am I going to make this bad bet on Portland to win the series just because I had this other bet, which seems like a good bet? So I didn't make the bet. And then when they were down 3-2, Portland was, I was like, well, I can't bet now. I should have bet when it was 3-1, and I didn't.
Sure.
So how could I bet now? And then in game 7, I was kind of like, wow, I really should have bet Portland, because it ended up being 3 games apiece. And they went to game 7. And game 7, I remember watching it in my brother's basement, my little 32-inch tube television. And I remember watching the game going, wow, this is like, it felt like the Lakers were, they were a big favorite in the game still. I can't remember how many points favored they were, but they were a favorite. But they were so tight, and they were just getting whacked. And they were actually down 12 going into the fourth. And at that point, I just didn't think I was going to win. And I was like, all right, well, that was fun, but it didn't look like it's going to work out.
I mean, could you explain to me? Because I just know from my own gambling experience that you have to sweat out something like that. It's pretty miserable. Like, I mean, could you explain it? And this was all the money, presumably, that you had.
Yeah, but it was
in the world.
But it
like,
wasn't
I understand
a big
that
deal.
You could make it back up.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I knew I was going to make money gambling regardless. I knew I was winning already at the time. I was quite successful. I had like a good record of like 1,000 bets over 3 years where I had like a decent winning percentage.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't that end of the world. It wasn't the worst. It wasn't the worst feeling I've had gambling since then. So it was just kind of like, I just kind of had like a back to work mentality. Like that didn't work. Let's just figure out another way to get. So that's kind of how I thought about it.
You do understand that's like crazy to 99% of the population.
It is, and it used to be a lot more impressive or crazy, but nowadays, like, I'm just so used to meeting all these 18-year-old, 19, 20-year-old kids who have like run $50 deposits into like $3 million on the internet playing poker. So to me, it doesn't seem that crazy.
Yeah, that's true. I mean,
or entering a $10,000 tournament and like banking $1.5 million in some WPT or World Series of Poker event. So it doesn't seem that. I guess maybe over time, it's seemed less and less impressive to me. It definitely wasn't the most humbling experience, like watching the team down 12 to start the fourth quarter in my gambling career. Like for me, that was going to watch the LA Clippers play the Phoenix Suns in game 7 and having like a really big bet on on the Clippers to win the series in like 05 or 06, I guess it was. Maybe it was 07.
With a Brandwagon team?
Yeah, 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 that team. I had like 3.5 to 1. I had like a big bet on the Clippers to win the series, and just being like sitting on the floor and having like 18,000 people like loudly cheer every time something goes bad your way was like the most humbling experience ever. Because I remember watching the game and they just like rained this parade of 3-point shots on the Clippers, and every one of them was like a punch in the stomach, and every time 18,000 people got up and started cheering. So I thought, I'm never ever traveling to watch a bet.
Oh, so you went to Phoenix for that
game.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm never doing that ever again. Because it's just, you feel so small. You just look around and you see all these people and you're like, wow, they all want me to lose. That sucks.
Okay. So then obviously the end of this story is that the Lakers come back in the fourth quarter because Rasheed Wallace like bricks every single shot.
No, it wasn't
him. The whole team bricks every shot.
Well, what happened was Portland started walking the ball up the court and using like 19 seconds of shot clock, like every possession before they even looked at something. And they ended up invariably getting like a player in the post or backing down and taking like a fall away jump shot for the entire, and then they just choked. I mean, they just became, the rim got smaller and smaller and smaller for them. And then the Lakers came back and won, and that was exciting. And then from there, I never really looked back. I moved away from Winnipeg, moved to Montreal, started betting a little bit more on basketball, making bigger bets, doing some different things. And that was pretty much it for me.
So you cashed out about $500,000 on
about
that.
About that,
bet. Yeah. And then since then, that's sort of grown exponentially.
Sure. Maybe. Yeah. Probably.
Yeah, to the point where you can, because you made a bet, you can fly and sit on the court. And,
right.
And have everybody hit you.
The brand, right, well, yeah.
I mean, so we are dealing with, like, large dollar amounts. It's something I want to talk to you. Like, the reason why we met was because I was in Las Vegas at the World Series of Poker writing a piece on the One Drop tournament, which ran on our site, I think, last week or something like that. That's something that you played in. Like, it was, for those who don't know, the One Drop was sponsored by Guy LaLiberté, who is the CEO, I guess, founder of Cirque du Soleil, who's a billionaire who's been to space. Like, he's
pretty lived
a lot
a pretty
of very high stakes poker games, lives a ridiculous life.
Yeah, really ridiculous life.
And he and I think his name is Mitch Garber, who is the CEO of Caesars Entertainment, decided to make this event at the World Series of Poker where the buy-in would be $1 million, and that they would try and get as many rich people and poker, sort of famous poker pros as possible to play for it, and they would televise it on ESPN and everything like that.
Yeah, the main impetus of it was 11.1%, or 11.11% was going to be of every entry fee was going to be donated to Guy's charity, which is the One Drop Foundation for water, helping people get water all over the place.
Yeah, clean water all over
clean
the world.
Clean water, yeah.
But you were sort of a gate crasher in this. Can you just explain the process of how you bought into this thing?
I kind of wanted to play the tournament, and then what happened was when they first announced this tournament, I was like, "Who the f*** is going to play this tournament? Give me a break." And then,
why did you feel that way?
Because it's $1 million.
There are people who have a lot of money in poker.
Well, but I didn't know. Yeah, but the people who have a lot of money in poker generally are good poker players.
Sure.
So I was like, well, I don't want to play a poker tournament with like Phil Ivey and Eric Seidel and. But then they started. Then more and more of the amateurs started saying, "I'm going to play this tournament." So at one point, I looked at the list, and they had I think 17 to 18 amateur poker players, not even amateur poker players, just like billionaire businessmen, or like 100 millionaire businessmen on the list of people who are going to play. And I was like, "Wow, this is a pretty good spot." I mean, if almost half the field is a recreational player, it's a good spot. I didn't think I was going to play, but I thought I was going to like buy pieces of people and take pieces of people in the tournament.
Okay, can you explain that thing? What does that mean?
It just means like the entry fee is $1 million. If you put up like let's say $500,000 for someone, you have 50% of their action, or you buy 50%.
So if like I was going to play in it, and you're like, look, we'll split the entry fee and we'll split whatever you win 50-50.
Right.
That's how you buy a piece.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of doing. And then somehow I found out about this guy who won a scratch-off ticket or a lottery ticket in Quebec and won some live combination of like scratch-off and live tournament seat where he won a ticket into the tournament and he was forced to play. It was a Lotto Quebec. Quebec's a province in Canada. And he was going to play in the tournament, but he also wanted to sell his seat versus playing, and the seat was transferable.
Sure.
So I somehow communicated with this person who won the seat, or who was brokering the deal on behalf of the person who won the seat. And so I was able to get my seat at a discount. So I didn't pay the full $1 million for my seat.
Mm-hmm.
And so now it looked like what looked like a decent investment looked like a great investment. Because even though I'm not a professional poker player, I don't play as much as these other guys do. If I'm able to get in for a discount and play this tournament, it felt like, okay, now I should play. So at first I was going to buy the seat and see if I could transfer it to someone else that I wanted to put in the tournament. And then they said, no, once we transfer it to you, you can't transfer it. So I thought, okay, I'll just buy it and play. And so I ended up playing the tournament. And that's the main reason why I played, is I thought it was good value. What I didn't understand, though, about the tournament was how quickly the hour levels went. The tournament was structured pretty fast in the sense that there was only hour levels, which normally is fine. But everyone in this tournament was acting so laboriously slow, like they were, like every decision was life and death. So you didn't get very many hands per hour. It was probably the slowest played tournament in the history of poker in terms of how fast people were playing.
So, do you think that had to do some with the field of amateurs, or do you think that it was just that people...
It was the spectacle of the whole thing, and sure, amateurs, and the fact that people were playing for quote-unquote $1 million, but the reality was most of the pros were playing for, you know, between $100,000 to $150,000 of action. They were playing for 10%.
Sure, I mean, like, I think that is a part of the poker...
But that's still a big amount of money, by the way.
People who watch it on TV don't really understand, which is that when... I mean, at any tournament, even like a $10,000 tournament, people sell off parts of their action and they buy.
But for
other
the most part,
action,
for
right?
the yeah, for the most part nowadays, there isn't that big of a backing circle. For the most part nowadays, people who are playing the $10,000 tournaments, most of them have almost all of their own action or a big percentage of their own action. But this was just a situation where people were playing for like 10%, 15% of their action.
Who are the people? Who are the types of people who buy other people's actions? I mean, is it like hedge fund managers or something like
no,
that?
No, it's. It was like it used to be the people who owned percentages of Full Tilt Poker were the guys. There was like these guys who randomly bought a percentage of Full Tilt and had all this money coming in, and just decided that, like, there was a couple famous staking stables, like this E Dog. He staked a bunch of players because he was living high off the hog of the Full Tilt money, and he had like a stable of like 20 or 30 players that he was putting in all these tournaments for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Phil Ivey was putting players in. This is before Full Tilt. He was putting players in, I think, up until like 06, and then he just gave up because he just hated it. He hated dealing with the people he was staking.
Sure.
And then like a couple other of the hotshot pros, like I think Daniel Negreanu has staked some people in the past. I know Jason Mercier has talked about having a stable of players. I never really got into the whole staking thing. I staked one guy who's a friend of mine. I was basically trying to help him out, and it was like the most miserable experience ever, like putting up $10,000. Because usually the way the stake isn't, the way these people who had stables of players, they're putting up 100% of the buy-in. And the player who's playing is on like a free roll with makeup. So,
okay. So it's just like, it's just small investments within poker.
Yeah. It's like a different, but this tournament was different because people were pieced out all over the place like you wouldn't believe.
How does that change it competitively, though? Because it's like, I guess for me, a lot of the appeal of the tournament, this is something I wrote about, which I think you consider was mean spirited, but I just thought I was, you know,
it's like the
I was
meanest,
trying to be as
meanest,
objective as
meanest
possible.
Article ever. It was like so meat like, laced with like all these.
That is not all right. Anyway, that's your opinion as a gambler and poker player who played in this. But one of the things that I was that for me, you know, some of the appeal of the tournament was lost when you figure out just how little. These guys are playing for themselves.
But if you say little, like $150,000 is a small amount of money. I mean, having $150,000 worth of your action in a tournament is a lot for some of these guys.
But I'm talking about for sort of the lay person who, the sort of weekend poker guy who has a home game who's watching this on TV.
I get that point. But also the weekend poker guy who's watching this on TV sees like a pot of like $130 million in tournament chips being shipped to someone and goes, oh my God, that guy just won $100. Like they have no clue that the tournament chips have no real value. So while I do agree with you that it was a bit of a con in some ways how much people were playing for, I don't think it's that big a deal.
Do you regret playing in it?
No, I would play that tournament every day. What I regret, I think, is that so it was an unusual tournament in that people it wasn't just the money, it was also like it was a you know, they announced it was like WWE, they were calling people's names out to start the tournament and you really walked I didn't do any of that stuff. But you know, it was just such a spectacle. So people were playing, you know, everyone wanted to win the tournament and was playing really, really, really careful. So the one thing I regretted a little bit was when there was about 17 or 20 people left. Because I was going to, my idea was I wanted to get a lot of chips when there was like 12 or 13 people left. Because basically the way the payout structure was structured, first prize got like 18 times your buy-in. And
like 18.4 million.
Yeah. But like ninth just got your buy-in back basically. And fourth got like 2.6 times your buy-in. So to make, you know, that's an unusual payout structure for a tournament. And briefly, what it is it meant you basically had to win or finish second or the tournament was a waste of time. So the only thing you really were playing for was to win or finish second.
Sure.
But I didn't see people playing that way. I saw people playing like, I gotta get back, I gotta like cash, and I gotta make this. They wanted to last as long as possible. It was like a reality TV show where they didn't want to get voted off. And people were just playing really, really careful. And so I just think that I thought if I just started like open shipping a lot of these hands, in other words, moving all in, when I had like 4 or 5 million over and over and over again, I didn't see, at my particular table, I didn't see what hands people were gonna call me with. They were playing so tight. That's the only thing I regret a little bit. But I would play that tournament every day of my life for the rest of my life. It was that juicy. I mean,
what made it juicy? Because
the amateurs didn't know how to play poker.
There are forums where
I had a guy at my poker table, my starting table on day one, who I think if you asked him what planet he was on, he would have said the right. You know, he knew he was in Las Vegas, and he knew he was, but he had no idea what was going on whatsoever. And he was a businessman, and he was a nice guy, and he was older, and at the start of the tournament, he was paying attention a little bit, but as the night after 4 hours of like playing poker for 4 hours, you know, this is, I don't know how old this guy is, but he's, you know, a CEO of like a big company or whatever. He's a really successful guy. He had checked out mentally. I mean, he was just like, what am I doing here? I have no idea. This is boring. I don't know. And he was like literally folding his hand. Like he was folding the small blind when the action was under the gun. He'd look at his cards and see that, okay, I have a bad hand. And can I fold now? Like, can I just get this over with?
He would fold like six turns.
When he was the blind. Yeah, when he was the blind.
That is ridiculous.
And so there was that. There was, he was the worst player in the field for
sure.
No, he was the worst player in the field for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, he didn't know where he was. I mean, I think at some point, like he fell asleep in the middle of play at the end. I mean, he's just like a guy who's not used to sitting there. Not people aren't used to sitting there and playing like 12 hours of poker or 10 hours of poker.
Yeah, 3 days in a row.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, and so at the end of day one, he had completely. He did pull this guy here was folding out of turn and doing all this stuff. But I kept on saying like, is it my turn to fold out of turn? Like I would say stuff like this as a joke and just kind of make him feel a little more comfortable. And he started to pick up on the fact that, oh, these guys know that I'm folding at a turn. And one time, it was his big blind, and he folded. And someone said, no, it's your big blind. He goes, oh. But he had two kings, and he knew that he, in other words, he faked. This is at the end of the night. So as bad a poker player as this guy was, he was a pretty smart guy. And he's pretty perceptive.
Like you said, he's probably a billionaire, right?
I mean, he was a billionaire for sure. And he was like, wow, these guys are making fun of me for folding. How can I use this to my advantage? And he folded his big blind. And of course the dealer said, no, it's your big blind. Bring your cards back. And he goes, oh, okay. And then he like just like called like three streets with two kings and like busted, you know, won like a huge pot off of someone. It was the craziest thing you'd ever seen.
Yeah, that is pretty good. All right. Well, let's the last thing I wanted to talk to you actually about was your sort of basketball betting operation, like, and your specialty is over unders, right? Or it used to be at least.
I think
at the beginning of
it
your,
was, yeah,
at the
yeah.
Beginning of betting career, like, can you just explain that? Because I think a lot of people think about betting as in like you watch a game and you're like, well, I don't think that this team has it. This and that you bet it on that, or you say that I think this line is wrong.
Yeah.
But you know, like really, sort of high. And sports bettors are always just trying to take advantage of inefficiencies in the lines and
sure.
Inefficiencies in the market. So, like, can you just explain how you started out thinking about this and, like, what you actually took advantage of first?
Well, for me, it was just the most natural. When I'm watching a basketball game, the pace of the game, how fast the team is playing, how easily they'll score on offense or how difficult they'll score was always just what I paid attention to. And to me, the most, like the purest bet in sports is an over-under bet on a basketball total because, you know, a game's going to have roughly, depending on the era, 90 to 100 possessions a game. And each individual play is worth a very, very small percentage of your actual bet. So if you bet like a total in a football game and a guy fumbles the ball, that's 7 points on like a total of 47 points or something.
Sure.
That's pretty. But in basketball, you're going to get a 3-point play, and that's going to be worth like 1.5% of your bet. So it's not that big of a deal. So that's I don't know why I got involved in totals, but it just became naturally what I was good at and what I paid attention to. And I think the totals are a little bit easier to predict than the spreads, but they're not so obscure that they're difficult to bet. You know, some of these things like betting on first quarter totals or betting on you know, how many points this particular player will score. You can't bet any money on those things. You can bet like maybe 1,000 or a couple thousand.
Yeah, 2,000.
But yeah, but if but you can bet a lot of money on a full game total. You can get down if your goal is to bet a lot of money. You can bet a lot of money. So to me, I just felt like, well, this is something that I can max my bankroll. I can bet as much as I want to bet for the most part. And I feel like I could have an edge if I model things right, I look at things the right way. So I just started looking at how teams would match up when I was doing my subjective stuff, and how they, you know, what type of style of basketball they would play. Would they try to push the pace? Would they try to slow the pace? Would they have, you know, difficulty scoring, that sort of stuff? And I just became, when you start paying attention to those things, and that's all you're paying attention to. Like, I'd watch a basketball game and someone would be like, who's winning? And I'd be like, I don't know, they're on pace for 206 points right now. I have no idea who's winning. I'd just be like, okay, 162 with like this much time left. And I just was always, I knew exactly how many points they were scoring, but I didn't really care who was winning.
Sure.
In some ways. And then I think early on in my career, I started betting half totals, first half totals and second half totals. And that's really when like the light switch went off for me. And I was like, wow, this is really easy. Because there was teams that had just very, very distinct personalities. The way they played the first half was sometimes markedly different than the way they played the second half. And I just kind of was the first person to really be aware of that on a grand scale and capitalize on it.
Can you explain that just a little bit, like elaborate a little bit?
Sure. So the way that halftime totals used to be made back in the day was if like the game total was 200 points, if, in other words, if the over-under for the full game was 200 points, in like the 2002-2003 season, the first half total was probably going to be 101.
Sure.
And the second half total was probably going to be 99. That's just how they made the line. They always made the first half total a little bit higher than the second half total. And in general, on average, that was the right line. But you had all these teams who had all these different ways of playing, where some teams, the right first half total might have been like 85, and the right second half total might have been 115.
So like, what's an example of a team like that?
Back then, it was like, well, there was three teams that had that philosophy in certain situations. And so like the Utah Jazz were like one of the teams that were kind of like that, because they ran like a flex offense, and they, in the first half of a game, they also had really bad, all these teams that did this were all really, really bad teams. This is like before Deron Williams. This is like when Carlos Arroyo was their starting point guard, I don't remember even some of these other guys, but they were Keith McLeod or something like that. They're just really bad players. And so they basically would just play like four corners in the first half. They would just sit there and like hold the ball for 19 to 20 seconds. And then, okay, now we're forced to shoot. Okay, we'll shoot. And that's kind of how they played in the first half, just trying to keep the game manageable a little bit.
Sure.
And then the second half, they'd open up a little bit. And then if the game ever got close, they would just really open up a lot and foul and really extend the game. And so that was one of the teams I bet a lot of first half under, second half overs. There were teams I bet first half over, second half unders too, like the Golden State Warriors back then.
Or the Golden State Warriors always.
Yeah, well, like the year that Gilbert Arenas was a rookie, like when he first started actually being a starter, I think they scored like 110 points in the first half, like on average, in like five or six games, and it took a long time for the handicappers or the lines makers to figure that out, because he was so fast. He was so much faster than anyone else on the court at the time.
And these are all, I mean, these are all, like, I guess what's interesting is that these also seem to be, these aren't, like you said, the word database is, I think, overused a lot right now. Like, these are sort of subjective, observational things that you
right.
use.
Back then, you could use a database. Because you could just look and see how many points is this team scoring in the first half on the road in this situation, how many are they scoring in the second half on the road in this situation. And you can do that. You could mine a database. And that's kind of what so first I went from purely subjective to then trying to back it up with some of the data work that I was doing. And all you had available back then was box score data. So very simple database stuff. Like, you know, I think Utah in 2003 was averaging like 80 some odd points in the first half and 106, both teams combined in the second half. Of games on the road that year. So that was very simple to me. Just, okay, I can just bet first half under, second half over on this Utah team. That was very,
sure.
And that was easy. But then what happened was, after like 3 or 2 or 3 years of me just completely crushing it and like rolling out of bed and looking to see who was playing. I mean, it was like the easiest job ever back then. It was like, there wasn't much. I was watching basketball.
It just back then, like, what were you like?
I started out betting like maybe 5 or 6,000 a game when I first started out, like in 2000. And then by the 2004 season, I was basically betting whatever I could bet without the line moving more than a point. I mean, I would bet, if you told me you can get $100,000, I would have bet $100,000. I would have, because it was just that easy.
But the problem is that once you bet, the line would move.
It would move, but it wasn't moving that much for a while. Like, for a while, people didn't really know what was going on. And by the 2005 season, the line was moving like 5 and 6 points from like, you know, in other words, if the first half total would have been 100 4 years ago, it was now opening 97 and closing like 94.
Based on your bet?
Based on what I had done in years past.
Okay.
And so what ended up happening was the lines makers had done the same, you know, they got the same database and they looked and saw, oh my gosh, this team is averaging this many points and this many points in the first half. We have to change the lines a little bit more drastically to combat what's going on. So what ended up happening was with those three or four teams I was betting that were like the easiest bets ever, those all went away. The value kind of disappeared. Mm-hmm. But you had all these other bets where they thought they were seeing some sort of trend or specific play where they thought a team was high scoring in the first half, low scoring in the second half, or vice versa. But it really was just random. So I ended up, instead of having like 150 or let's say maybe 80 times, maybe like 250, 300 bets a year, with like a 10 or 12 or maybe even 16% ROI, like a ridiculous ROI.
Which is like, right, yeah.
Yeah, return on investment, which return is huge. In other words, every time you bet a dollar, you're just going to win 16 cents.
Yeah.
It came to the point where now maybe I had like maybe 700 or 800 or 1,000 bets, but my return on investment might have only been like 4 or 5% or 3%. So sure. So it took away one thing, but it created a whole other thing where now they had trouble making lines for all the teams. So there was a year of adjustment in the 05 season where I kind of was like treading water when they made like the drastic adjustment, took away what I considered to be my bread and butter plays. And then I kind of struggled and broke even and had like a decent year for a bit and then lost money in 05. Then I kind of took a year off that summer doing what I was normally doing and did like some more advanced work with play-by-play stuff and tried to work on a different way of approaching it.
Because the easy way of doing it, sort of like, I mean, all that sort of resulted in you building this sort of small basketball empire, huh?
Yeah, and that was actually the best thing that ever happened to me looking back, was because that wasn't sustainable. I mean, anyone, any moron who could like go to some website and see what a team was scoring in the first half could do what I was doing. It wasn't hard. It's pretty easy, as a matter of fact. But it became really, really tough in 05 and 06. And around the same time, now you've had about 2 or 3 years of play-by-play data. So you've got more data you can work with. So then people started doing like some different types of analytics where it's, you know, on-court, off-court type stuff or different types of modeling with based on matchups and other things, which is kind of what I do now.
All right. I think we're like running out of time here, which just, but yeah, I mean, I just wanted to, I don't know, are you betting on, I just wanted to ask you just to end.
The Olympics?
Like, is there anything? Are you betting on?
I was gonna bet $10 million to win 4,000 on the U.S. to beat Nigeria. I was like, if someone told me there was $4,000 laying across the street, like I would cross the street and go pick it up for sure.
Wait, is that?
I might even drive a couple blocks
to win 4,000.
Yeah, that's what it was. I was like, I might even drive like a couple blocks to pick up $4,000. This is easy money. Yeah. But then I was like, how am I? You know, it's hard to get $10 million in credit to bet this event. And I actually called up a friend.
Wait. So you're serious? You were thinking about betting $10 million to win $4,000?
Even if I didn't have $10 million, I would have bet $10 million to win 4,000. Because it's like, how could the team ever lose to Nigeria? It was like a joke.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Like they were favored by 55 points. I mean, in what world could they have lost that game? Like, I was like looking, okay, what happens if, like, I mean, there's no way they could lose. So I was like, this is free money. But only a couple of bookmakers were taking the bet, and I think the most you could bet was like to win $100 or something like that.
Yeah, I don't know if those bookmakers would be comfortable taking your $10 million bet.
They're only risking 4,000. I mean, it's like, whatever,
sure.
A million to win 400 maybe, I don't know. It was a joke, whatever it was. So yeah, that was the only bet I looked at and was like, oh, that has actually has some value, as crazy as that sounds. Like free $4,000.
All right, man. Well, thanks for coming on the BS Report.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And you know, I hope that once Bill gets back and the basketball season starts up, like, you know, that you can be.
I'd like to hear
your voice again, because again, I don't think any man has watched more basketball over the last 10 years than you.
Yeah, no, and, it would be hard. I would feel sorry for the person who did.
Yeah, it's always an interesting talk.
All right, I appreciate it. Thanks, Jay.
All right, and just on a personal note, I have a novel that came out today, and it's called The Dead Do Not Improve. You can find it on Amazon or any of the booksellers online, or you can actually go into a physical bookstore, as strange as that sounds, and pick it up today, and there will be an excerpt of it running today, actually, that ran this morning on Grantland as well. So hopefully you can help support that. You can just think of it as like a $14 Kickstarter investment and all the Jeremy Lin coverage that you would ever want. So, all right, well, yeah, this has been the BS Report, and I think we're done.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNradio.com.
Okay.